So I didn't even get to ask you about your White House days because of my obsession with Lexington.
Yeah, I told you about what happened with the Washington Post and Lee Sullivan and the no-frills methadone. But about a month after that, I was in Oklahoma giving a talk. And there was a DEA agent in the audience. And during the Q&A, he said, Dr. Cleaver, Oklahoma is thinking of adopting a triplicate prescription. What do you think about it? And I said, well, I'm not a big fan of triplicate. I think it does more to interfere with appropriate prescribing than it does to prevent diversion. And that was the end. It was clear to the agent that I knew what I was talking about. But 2 weeks later, Bennett was in Oklahoma giving a talk. And I had not bothered to tell him what happened because I didn't think it was very important. Same agent is in the audience and says, Director Bennett, what do you think of triplicate prescriptions? He said, I never heard of it. I don't know what you mean. What is it? And the agent says, well, it's a way of keeping dishonest doctors from diverting dangerous drugs onto an unsuspecting public. And Bennett says, well, sounds good to me. And the agent says, well, your deputy, Dr. Cleaver, was here a few weeks ago and said he thinks it's a bad idea. And Bennett gets up and says, if my deputy, Dr. Cleaver, says it's a bad idea, it's a bad idea and we're against it. And then when he comes back to the White House, he says, okay, Herb, what is triplicate and why are we against it? And being the honest intellectual that Bill is, we delegated DEA to write a paper, a briefing paper, on why they favor triplicate, and NIDA to write a briefing paper on why they thought it was a bad idea. And then they presented it to Bill and I as the judge and jury. And after that, you know, we decided that we were not going to favor what DEA wanted, which was a national triplicate system. Mm-hmm.
So that illustrates somewhat your role as a physician. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily have taken that position had you not the perspective of a physician.
Yes, and in those days, the job was extraordinarily important. The office was important. The leader was wonderful. We were able to do things in government that really mattered. I mean, we doubled the budget for treatment. We doubled the budget for prevention. We had a number of innovative programs. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to think I played some role in that. But a lot of it was because I had a very supportive director who wasn't afraid of exercising his clout.
And what about NIDA? Your relationship with NIDA, ONDCP, the sort of interagency relationship, what was that like?
Well, if you look at an organizational chart, you know, ONDCP is a White House agency. It's a part of the executive branch, and the director is a cabinet-level position. NIDA is, so if ONDCP is here on an organizational chart, NIDA is here. It's a speck in the universe. That is, the director of NIDA reports to the director of NIH, who reports to the assistant secretary of health, who reports to the undersecretary of health, who reports to the secretary of health. In fact, I will give you another anecdote, which probably shouldn't be public because I don't want to embarrass Fred. But when I first started, Fred Goodwin headed Adam Hawk. And the head of NIDA was Bob Schuster, who was an old friend. And Fred came to see me one day. And because we outranked them, the people ever came to my office. And he said, Herb, I know you're friendly with Bob Schuster, but you're in the government now, and there's a pecking order. So if anything you need to say to Bob Schuster, you need to say it to me. And I will delegate it to Bob Schuster. And I said, Fred, I don't understand. if we're going through the pecking order, if I have anything to say to Bob Schuster, I will say it to the Undersecretary of Health, because that's what I'm equivalent to, who will say it to the Assistant Secretary of Health, who will say it to you, who will say it to Bob Schuster. And Fred said, no, you can tell me directly because we're old friends. Needless to say, if I wanted to talk to Bob Schuster, I picked up the phone and called Bob Schuster. I mean, I did not tolerate that kind of Washington nonsense. Mm-hmm. But yes, it was important to have a physician in job. It was important to have someone who had the ear of the field, the respect of the field. Mm-hmm. Although it was a difficult decision to make. I mean, when Bennett first offered me the job, I was very conflicted. Marion, in fact, opposed my taking it because at that point the salary was just a little bit higher than my alimony. You know, while I was at ONDCP, I went into debt about $150,000. I would pass grades and say to the homeless guy there, you know, why don't you move over? I need this more than you do. But the main reason was that I was reluctant was not the money, because I figure you can always make money, that's not an issue. But because the research was doing so well at Columbia. Yeah. I mean, at Yale. Yeah. I had a wonderful group of young faculty, and our research was terrific. And so I called my mentor, Danny Friedman. You know, one of the grand old men. He had been a professor at Yale when I was a resident, and then became chair at Chicago, and then chair at UCLA. He was editor of the Archives of General Psychiatry. And throughout my life, he's been my mentor until he unfortunately died. And so I called Danny, and I told him the story. And I said, Danny, it's not a good time. And he said, Herb, when it is a good time, they won't offer you the job. So if you want to do it, do it. And the future will take care of itself. And he was absolutely right, and I did it, and I had no regrets. It was... I was there about 2.5 years. They were wonderful years. I think we were able to accomplish a lot. In fact, we had to sign off on NIDA moving to NIH. Our office had sign off. You know, if we hadn't signed off, they couldn't move NIDA. They could have moved NIAAA and NIMH, but they could not have moved NIDA without our permission. And one of the things I held out for in the negotiations with Bernadine Healy, who was head of NIH at the time, was I did not want the NIDA review committees to be merged into NIH right away.
Yes. That was you?
Yes. Because I said, you know, it'll be a disaster. I wanted 5 years. Bernadine wanted it right away. And we compromised between 3 and 4 years.
And so after 3 or 4 years, they are now merged.
Although there are still some separate NIDA review groups.
Yes, and why did you think it would be such a disaster?
Oh, because the scientists at NIDA had not been competing in that NIH framework. They spoke a different language in many ways. And the NIH scientists neither knew nor cared much about substance abuse. And I thought the NIDA grants would get very short shrift. There needed to be a mutual education process.
And did that indeed happen?
That indeed happened. And NIDA has done very well at NIH.
How did that mutual education process take place?
Probably I'm not the best person to answer that.
Who would be good?
I think Alan would be very good. Alan Leshner.
Yes.
Because Bob Schuster left around 91. He left really before the move took place. Mm-hmm. So Alan, you know, Dick Milstein. Dick Milstein became the interim.
Yes.
Until Alan was chosen as the full-time director. So, and Dick is now at the Fogarty Center. And he'd been with NIDA for many, many years. And then when Nora took over and she didn't make him her deputy, but made Tim Condon her deputy, Dick left and went to the Mills, to the Fogarty Center. Mm-hmm. But he has a long historical memory of NIDA.
He'd be good.
Yes, he'd be very good on that. As would Alan. Because Alan had a very good perspective, because before he became NIDA director, he'd been deputy director of NIMH for about 8 or 9 years.
Can I ask you, what do you think about the sort of competing framework between behavioral pharmacology and neurobiology, to put, just to make it a blunt question? Do you think that neurobiology has now eclipsed behavioral pharmacology within NIDA?
There are fashions. Mm-hmm. Under Bob Schuster, behavioral pharmacology reigned king. Alan felt that behavioral pharmacology was far too powerful and did his best to downgrade behavioral pharmacology while he was head of NIDA. It took a while because it was very well ingrained, and not ingrained, entrenched would probably be a better word. I think Nora is trying to restore balance between behavioral pharmacology and neurobiology, because the behavioral pharmacologic techniques are still, you know, very important for medication development. The guy at Brookhaven, Steve Dewey, held a press conference a couple years ago about this new drug that he was trying with monkeys, and gave a press conference how he felt it was going to be effective medication for cocaine, for nicotine, etc. And the New York Times called me for a quote, because they figure I'm usually quotable. And I said, well, just like the stock market has predicted 10 out of the last 3 recessions, animal research has predicted 10 out of the last 0 effective drugs for cocaine. Yes, we need a balance.
So it wasn't that Alan Leshner thought that neuroscience should be elevated, but he actually, you think, thought that behavioral pharmacology had too much credence in.
Well, I think so. He felt both.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Because that was his background, just like Bob's background with behavioral pharmacology. Alan's was more neuroscience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he came from NIMH, and before that from NSF. Not NSF. Yeah, NSF, National Science Foundation.
Did you consider him one of you?
Well, I'm the one who encouraged Alan to apply for the job.
So you saw potential in
yes.
him.
Mm-hmm. I'm the one that, because the field did not want him.
Yeah.
Because they felt he was not one of them.
Yeah.
So I was the one that made sure that he came to NIDA meetings, and met the movers and shakers in NIDA and helped get the old guard behind him, just like I was one that encouraged Nora to apply for the NIDA job and was on the search committee that interviewed and made the final decision in terms of who got recommended to Dr. Serhunian. People had approached me right after Marion died, both for the ONDCP job, because John Walters was not in that job yet, and for the NIDA job. And the quote I used was that before Marion died, she knew that both jobs would be vacant. And she had me promise that I would stay at Columbia and take care of our 120 children. And I never broke a promise to her while she was living, and I saw no reason to do it after she died. And so I refused any of the jobs from Washington, and, you know, partially because of the promise to her, and partially because I love research. I, again, am surrounded by a wonderfully talented group of people. And we've been very successful. We started with practically nothing at Columbia. We're now the largest division in psychiatry. We've been number 1, 2, or 3 in the United States in drug and alcohol abuse research in that U.S. News ranking.
Michael Crow was at Columbia when you, was he, who was president of Columbia when you?
Oh, Mike Sovereign.
Mike Sovereign.
Yeah, Mike Sovereign was president, and then George Rupp. And then most recently, Lee Bolling.
Okay.
Yeah, Columbia was very welcoming. The key person was not the president, but her parties.
Uh-huh.
Her with both chair of psychiatry and the dean of the medical school. And an old friend. When I was on the NIDA council in the 70s, I was the NIDA council representative to the NIMH council. And Herb at that time was director of NIMH, so that's how I first met him.
Mm-hmm.
So when I, when it became time for me to leave ONDCP, I let word out that Marion and I were looking to recruit together. And we got very good offers from a number of medical schools, and we chose Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I could keep going on,
yeah, no,
on government stories, but yes. But all the nice thing about being in government at that level and really being the only, you know, other than Lou Sullivan, you know, my position outranked any other physician in the U.S. government, including the head of NIH,
mm-hmm.
whatever. I thought I had solved the medical marijuana problem. That is, in the 80s, there was a compassionate IND program for marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
HHS permitted about 30 people to get marijuana from the farms in Mississippi that NIDA had.
Right.
And then came AIDS. And the AIDS activists decided that this should not be limited to 30 people. And suddenly HHS got swamped with thousands of applications. You had a few doctors who learned how to apply and were willing to fill out the papers for anybody who they thought might benefit. And so HHS was swamped with the possibility of suddenly thousands of people getting marijuana at a extraordinarily high cost, as well as doing things that might really disturb the government's position on marijuana. And so HHS decided that they wanted to end the compassionate marijuana program, except for individuals already receiving it. And I felt they should not do that without setting into place the research to see whether marijuana had any potential. I mean, it's easy to end something, but I held out that HHS could not do that without getting NIH to do the research to see whether indeed there were elements in chemicals in marijuana that could be used to usefully treat a variety of conditions. And NIH promised me that they would do that. They lied. And later when I asked Harold Varmus, he said, well, none of the institutes were interested in doing it. I said, well, that wasn't our agreement. It wasn't that they were going to want to do it. The agreement was they were going to do it. But they never did. And that's why over the last 4 or 5 years, it's reemerged. You have all these medical marijuana mm-hmm. initiatives,
yep.
Which I think should have been solved 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow. So, as we used to say in Washington, the motto is, we'll double cross that bridge when we come to it.
Thank you so much.
It is my pleasure. The newest motto I've been